We are starting the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and story, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. In today's show, I do an extended interview with Henry Phillips. Included, Henry singing some of his fun songs. You can find him at Henry's Kitchen on YouTube. After the interview, a piece by Susanna Hancock called Platforms, a compelling new classical work, which will be performed on June 11th, that's Saturday at 8 p.m., at the Boomtown Brewery. This is presented by the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, LACO. More information at laco.org. And then after that, a selection from Eine kleine Nacht music by Mozart. This is to get you ready for a show at the Broad in Santa Monica, June 9th through the 12th. The Mark Morris Dance Group and Music Ensemble, they will be featuring dances performed to Mozart. Go to thebroadstage.org for more information. While you're at thebroadstage.org, check out the Conference of the Birds. That's June 18th and 19th. Also an extraordinary show. Stay tuned.
All right, why don't I do this song? This is a song that I wrote for the girl that I was seeing. I was in my eighth year of community college down there at Pasadena City College. And I met her, and when I first met her, she didn't speak a word of English, and I didn't speak, whatever language she spoke, but this was just a song that I wrote for her back in those days. And it's probably one of the first songs I ever wrote. You are the blossom, I am the vine. You are the blossom, I am the vine. Sweet little blossom of mine, hanging on the vine, extracting all the nutrients from the inside. Sweet little blossom of mine. You are the oyster, I am the pearl. You are the oyster, I am the pearl. Sweet little oyster of mine, irritating you on the inside, covering me with your shiny mucus-like substance until I shine. Sweet little oyster of mine, I am the host organism. You are the unicellular dinoflagellate algae. I am the host organism. You are the unicellular dinoflagellate algae. This is the part where I have everybody sing along with me. Sweet little unicellular dinoflagellate algae of mine, letting me use your chloroplast that I can photosynthesize, providing me with carbon in exchange from the nutrients you obtain from my catabolic pathways. Sweet little unicellular dinoflagellate algae of mine. Okay, so there's about 38 more verses of this one, so it's about a 40-minute song. No, I'm kidding. That's the last one. You are the J-Lo, I am the Ben. You are my J-Lo, I am your Ben. Sweet little J-Lo of mine, right there by my side. Still supporting me after a 17-year breakup while I come to terms with my alcohol and addiction issues so that we can eventually get back together and make more crappy movies. Sweet little J-Lo and my... Wow, that was a little bit of a mouthful at the end there. I first started performing that song in like 1996... And then just a little after that, everybody was talking about J-Lo and Ben. So I was like, well, maybe I'll put a verse about you're the J-Lo and I'm the Ben. And then they fell out of the news. But recently they're reuniting and that's back in the news. So I figure, oh, maybe I can sort of rework it and revise the lyric.
Milk so that another was, hit out of it.
Yeah, milk it, you know. I have friends that are comedians in the clubs, and they'll just come up with fake news stories just so that they can get their old joke in there. Like if they have a joke about, I don't know, Cats the Musical or whatever. Like so I heard they're going to revive Cats the Musical, which is probably total BS. But this way, that gives them an opportunity to say their classic Cats joke or whatever.
The confusing thing about Cats is there's no plot.
Yes.
There's no character arc. It's about nothing. It's about these animals standing up and just saying, I'm here. It's just not.
I know.
Why is this so famous? Why do people like this? I do not understand.
Well, I wonder if, because I was definitely part of the target demo for it, I guess you would say. Like, I was a fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber because of Jesus Christ Superstar. Like, I thought that was the coolest thing ever. I grew up learning the lyrics for it and everything. And then I got into Evita, which was the follow-up, which I wasn't as into, but still was on board. And with Cats, I heard that as soon as the musical came out, I went out and bought the soundtrack. And it was a little bit of a guilty pleasure because it was very kids-sounding music. But I was like, there's some fun instrumental stuff going on, and there's good songwriting. It's the same pair, right? It's that same guy, Tim Rice, who wrote the lyrics for Jesus Christ Superstar. But then when I went and saw it, I think I saw it out here in L.A., it was hard to watch because it was just so... I guess they were being kind of artsy with the costumes and stuff, but it was kind of... pretentious, and I wasn't even into the kind of thing that they're going for anyway. I don't want to rag on it, you know, but of course it's gotten its share of criticism. I did not see this movie.
Where they airbrushed out the anuses?
Oh, did they do that?
Yeah, that's apparently according to the late night.
Oh my goodness! You would have to.
Experts.
Yeah.
Do you have another tune or two?
Well, I guess this would be about another one of the first songs. For some reason, I find myself later in my life going back to the original songs that I wrote because they've stood the test of time more than the more recent ones. But this is based on a quote from Isaac Newton when he was asked how he was able to see so far and so clear. He humbly said it was because he was standing on the shoulders of giants. And that's become sort of a famous quote. And this song is sort of my take on that. Ancient philosophy was framed by prodigies. Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates. And even though their thoughts were deemed the aristocratic voice, they also had a thing for little boys. Catherine the Great, so it's been said, needed farm animals to be fulfilled in bed. From historic rulers to the ancient Greeks, we're standing on the shoulders of freaks. Isn't life pretty earnest, Hemingway once said. And then he put a bullet through his head. Salvador Dali's surreal paintings were godsend. You'd never know he wore his own excrement. Then there's Da Vinci, for whom it required wearing women's underwear to become inspired. From the great romantics to the ancient Greeks, we're standing on the shoulders of freaks.
there's that one. That one,
yes! April 6, 2022. Henry Phillips. I first saw you, so it was in a basement in West Hollywood at some hotel.
That, yeah, it used to be a Ramada Hotel, and then they changed it to, like, the Hollywood Hotel or something. But it's on, was that on Vermont and Santa Monica Boulevard? Something like that. Hollywood.
I think it had the distinction of being where the most axe murderers were committed in Hollywood. So, you know, that was...
Oh, I'm sure. It wasn't uncommon for comics to just call each other up and say, hey, want to do my show? And back then...
Ian Jasper put it together.
Oh, yeah.
Ian Jasper.
Yeah, well, that name I know.
Funny guy.
Yeah. Well, this was, I guess that was about 10 years ago.
Okay.
Something like that. It's kind of a funny story about that place, too, because in the Coronet Bar, which was also the Coronet Theater or whatever, and I was just sitting next to this guy who just sort of took over the entertainment at the Ramada, at that hotel that we're talking about. At the time, it was a Ramada. I think a lot of these hotels, I found out later, just buy the name and they buy the rights to use the name, but the Ramada probably has no idea what's happening there. And so this guy, Gust was his name, he said, yeah, man, you know, if you ever want to do something at this room, let me know. And I was like, you know, I always wanted to do like a Henry Phillips and Friends type situation, you know, where it's just all the people that I've met in the comedy business and we put on a show, you know. Oh, and that was another funny thing. I was going through a breakup and I didn't want my ex-girlfriend to know about the show. So try playing that game where you're trying to promote a show, but you don't want it to somehow reach a certain person in your circle. Like, that's a really difficult thing to pull off. So
she wouldn't come in with a fire extinguisher.
Well, I didn't want her to show up with a date, you know, or anything. Yeah, I was just sort of like, I wanted to move on from that chapter of my life. And so that was really a
funny,
difficult game to play.
That's a fun scenario. Like, yeah. To keep your ex... this toxic ex from coming to
I know.
That's a movie.
It is toxic too, because like how much we're limiting our success if we don't want somebody to find out. I mean, imagine somebody with a Nobel Prize is like, oh, I don't want my ex-wife to know that I got the Nobel Prize, so I think I'm just going to not do it. Or,
and that is a problem.
The
challenge. In fact, I had that same problem and I turned it down.
Yeah.
Because...
it's not even worth it
to
deal with the ex and what her response will be to your Nobel Prize.
Well, this brings up the question of the artist and then promoting the artist. And we just hate promoting. We hate selling tickets, trying to get people into seats. It's just the bane of all us creative people. And sometimes the worst human beings who are good at promotion end up getting famous or filling auditoriums, but they're not that good sometimes. They're just good at branding.
Yeah, and, or they've hooked up with someone who fulfills that role,
you
know, a record
label. A toxic
ex. Yeah, exactly. It's really difficult. You always have to do it. Comedians are in this interesting, I think, a different... predicament, because so for years I've done comedy clubs, you know, like Go Bananas in Cincinnati or whatever, and there's all my friends that are comedians will all talk about this particular thing, and even people that have gotten really big will be like, I have to stand there after the show and sell my CDs. But, you know, nobody I idolize in music, you know, it's like Tom Waits doesn't sell his CDs after the show. So wouldn't that cheapen it a little bit if you're like, you know, if Mick Jagger was there saying like, hey, come on, buy my CDs. You know, it takes away the cool factor that you just had by being on stage. And yet we have to do it. And a guy like, I remember Jim Gaffigan talking about it, and he's a pretty big comic. And, he was doing that, you know, like having to sell, you know, it's like, at what point do you not have to stand there and sell your CDs anymore? But comics, for some reason, since part of being a successful comic is having an everyman sort of a quality to you, then people feel more comfortable approaching you, and they know more about your personal life, because for an hour you just talked about your marriage or your lack of meeting anybody or whatever. They know all your foibles, so you're much more accessible, whereas a musician always has this sort of mystique about them, and they're just like, we're done, we're going to go to the bus, the groupies are going to sell the CDs, and we'll just spend the money on pot or whatever. I don't know what they do, but I do feel like comedians are, they look like a dick if they're not out there selling their stuff afterward and talking to you.
Well, there is that everyman thing makes people relatable, and I'm the poor schlub. I mean, there are exceptions to that. There are comedians who are also,
oh, I'm sure,
high and mighty.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
Different,
yeah,
personas. But I remember producing a lot of shows myself. This is more like in kind of yoga studios and dancing and meditation. I just got sick of flyers and handing them out and trying to get my friends to go. Then this radio thing came along, and you know, Lord knows, tens of thousands of people listen to me every week.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like easy now. I don't have to.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm trying to do the math. Tens of thousands. That means that if every one of those people,
yeah,
went to my website and bought a CD, that would be some good.
Well, it's, I'm actually extremely famous. The challenge I've had is that people aren't aware of that.
Mm.
That's, as soon as I can cross that threshold,
yeah,
people know I'm famous. Boom, it's,
yeah,
on. And
yeah, that's what you want to work on. That's the hard part, I would say.
But I would call myself a minor media personality.
Yeah.
I'm a personality.
Well, I've listened to the show and I love it. I think it's great, seriously.
So you are a comedian, a brilliant songwriter, but we recently reconnected because you were making wonderful, insightful comments on one of these social media platforms. You were being respectful, but answering these morons with, you know, dignity, but insight. And I liked it because I tend to be just like call them idiots.
I appreciate that. I've had times when I'm in a disagreement with somebody and I want to just say, oh, you're just some kind of idiot or whatever. I've found it doesn't work. We live in this time where we have the internet, which is an enormous advantaged. I mean, it's allowed people, without going on too much of a tangent, but in my business particularly, for example, in the 90s, if you wanted to be successful being a comedian, you had two options. One, you could be on a TV show on a network, you know, like you could be the star, like Seinfeld or something like that. And just, that's like winning the lottery. You're just worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars and you retire and everything's great. Or you do comedy clubs all around the country and make, you know, a couple hundred dollars a night or whatever, and you get very road-worn and you live out your life and eventually you hang yourself
in
a hotel.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard.
But yeah, so those were the two options. But now, because of the internet, we have so many things in between. You can have a podcast. I have two web series that I do. You can make your own music and upload it to the same platforms that Taylor Swift puts her music on, you know, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever. And that's amazing. It's really democratized everything so that we can all have a voice. The disadvantage, on the other hand, is I think that misinformation has been allowed to flourish. We all know, I guess, that there is a tendency to gravitate toward information that we like, that also makes us feel better about ourselves for whatever reason. And so people are seeking out the kind of information that they want to be true instead of having it rub against them a little bit, you know. And they're being, in my opinion, manipulated by some things that, well, the conspiracy theories is the biggest thing. And I'm not saying it's impossible for conspiracies to happen, but they do all seem to have some through lines to them that I think are a little worrisome. A lot of them are very religious. I've never really been a very religious person. But I don't remember the specific conversation that we were talking about, but I imagine it probably had something to do with government conspiracies or this kind of thing. Do you remember what the topic was?
I don't, but, you know, this is new technology where suddenly anybody who wants to speak has a platform and anybody can be heard, which is kind of new throughout history. And we're in this maladaptive phase. It's this kind of this Mad Max world. And I feel like it's necessary for all this ugliness to come out. There's just has to be this big brawling in the street and people sinking to the lowest common denominator and just all this ugliness, because this is what humans are. This is a part of humanity and it has to just vomit out. But I predict at some point we go, yeah, we've done that and it's awful, and now let's turn to something a little more elevated. This is my prediction. Mm-hmm. And that might be a week or 1,000 years from
yeah
now.
I agree. Yeah, and I wow, that's a great insight. And the more I think about it, it really resonates, because we have almost an earthquake happening or a paradigm shift. I don't know what paradigm shift means, but I've heard a lot of people say it. But I
throw
think
it in the, you know, right? But I like that. I'll throw in yeah. some good words too. I don't know what they mean.
Yeah, but we have this rupture, whatever happening. And eventually it'll flatten out and everything will be quiet and we'll be like, what the hell was that? But we'll all be a little bit smarter afterward. And you're right. The good news is I'm starting to see people have to become familiar with certain terms. You know, like I've heard a lot of people say the straw man fallacy or confirmation bias or all these terms that people on both sides of the information spectrum are coming up with.
They both one side hears it and they grab it from
yeah.
So the dark forces are very good at quickly adapting, and like the Borg,
yeah,
they mutate into evil very quickly and grab whatever propaganda
yeah.
they can
yeah.
to support their sinister ways.
Yeah, but if I am telling somebody, okay, the fallacy that you're using is you're assuming that because of a small part of people doing something that that's happening on the whole or whatever. And then they'll have to suddenly realize that that's a counter argument to whatever they're trying to put forward. And then from that point, it's part of everybody's vocabulary. So if somebody tries to do it to them, they can point it out and say, aha, you're just using one isolated incident and saying that that's happening everywhere, but you have no evidence for that. So
it's a very good point. It becomes manipulated.
Yeah.
It's like it's a true statement, but then it becomes used in reverse.
Yeah. So I guess the optimist in me says that eventually it'll reach some kind of equilibrium where everybody is aware of all of the little tricks that people try to pull with misinformation and everything like that. But going back to your original statement, just calling somebody stupid, as good as that feels when you do it, because they don't see things the way that you do, I just don't think it's effective, because then they're going to continue to be in an echo chamber and just only associate with people that agree with whatever that it is that they agree with. Boy, I was just listening to talk radio on the way over here, just because it happened to be on my the radio and in the car, and wow, I haven't listened to that in years, but that's some serious crap. I'm like, boy, are they getting people who are sitting in traffic and are already angry about the fact that it's taken them an hour and a half to go home, but just poking at them on top of that, and also saying that, you know, certain people are responsible for every bit of pain that you're feeling and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, boy, it can't possibly be healthy or constructive for everybody to be this angry. And the talk radio thing, I think that they get more ratings or something when they get people angry. It's just a more primal engagement.
Well, that's,
you know,
Fox News.
The
more scared and angry you can get, the more people
fear-mongering.
But, you know, I think this betrays my allegiance, but it seems to me like one side of the political divide, there's no bottom, is deceptive and mean and narrow-minded and violent as they can get, as they can get away with. That's what they'll do. That's kind of the way they're built. And the other side of the political divide actually has standards that, like, they want kindness and truth and dignity. So they're not as good at brawling. They're not as good at being evil. They're not as good at getting in the ring and punching it out.
I agree.
So one side tends to kind of win because they're better at this, just like mudslinging and evil.
If somebody's willing to punch below the belt.
This is the issue in society. The underlying rule is, what's the law of the jungle? It's might makes right, and people trend to wanna get away with as much as they can get away with. They will take advantage of others to the extent they can get away with it. And that's the bottom floor of the civilization we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are living there and reverting there. And and people are proud of it, like what they get away with. And they really only get upset by being caught. They're not actually ashamed of malice.
Yeah.
They're just unhappy that now they have consequences.
Oh, absolutely.
So this is in the human spirit. By the way, you're a comedian and a political scientist, very well spoken. But here we're, you know, how quickly things lead to these more primary discussions. And I appreciate somebody who's a humorist who can still, you know, talk about deep matters.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, when I was in college, I started writing these songs that all had a political bent to them because that's what I was. I was learning about it all the time. It was fun to... I had a song called Your Tax Dollars at Work, which was all of the ridiculous things that our tax money goes to, you know, excessive, you know, inefficient type things or whatever. But that's always been an easy target. But I stopped doing it at some point because my life went into a different place where I was just having fun. And when I went to a club somewhere in the country and I saw 300 people, I didn't see like half of them are left wing, half of them are right wing or whatever. I just saw a bunch of people that came to laugh, and I was like, well, why don't I talk about universal things like how difficult it is to talk to the opposite sex or an extremely embarrassing moment that I had or whatever. And I was completely happy never even getting into the politics of it. And there are some people that are really good at it, and I appreciate that they're doing that. But in my comedy, I haven't found a voice that works for me to be very political, which is ironic because that's kind of how I started. But things weren't quite as divisive, I think. And you know what? There's also always the possibility that you can be wrong and realize several years later that you were wrong about something, whatever it was that you were singing about, and then that recording is just sitting there forever of you being wrong about something.
That's funny. Yes.
And, you know, that's always a risk that you have to take. But, well, a lot of my songs didn't age well that I was doing in the clubs because I'd flippantly use terminology that became slurs or that were already slurs that I wasn't aware of how offensive they were to certain people. And
Struggles of
these are all
saturated.
Things,
Well, you have the late night talk show hosts that are trending more progressive, and their humor is fun and light. And yes, they're taking jabs at the right wing, but it's playful. But if you go to like right wing humor, like on Fox News, it's so snarky and mean and angry.
Oh,
like
yeah.
The kind
and
of humor.
It's a lot of really low-hanging fruit.
The style of humor is very different. One is playful, one is vicious.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's just a couple of quote-unquote jokes that I just keep hearing. It's like, I don't find the joke offensive. I just am offended by the fact that you think that anybody hasn't already made that joke. Like this thing about transgender people where it's like, oh, I identify. Like somebody, some senator or something just recently tweeted a picture of a golf ball that said, I identify as being in bounds or whatever. It's like, oh, I'm going to really increase my golf game now that my golf ball, like making fun of this idea that you're whatever you identify as or whatever. And it's like, boy, do you think you're the first person that's made that joke? It's so stupid. It's based on such... I mean, he might as well have just tweeted, I'm an ignorant person. I don't really listen to what the other people in the world are trying to say, you know, so I don't know.
So one side isn't funny, I think.
Yeah, but then again, I think sometimes they are, you know, they can be. I think a lot of what George Carlin was saying was nowadays would be considered a little bit more right wing. He was very against political correctness, for example. And other things like that.
And Russell Brand, well, he was one of my favorite comedians and brilliant and open-minded and visionary, but he seems to have taken a dark turn. Russell Brand into conspiracy talking points and QAnon crap.
Yeah, I mean, do we know what his history is? I mean, is he an expert in any of this stuff?
Well, he's a he's brilliant.
He's a comedian, but like, does he have a background in, for example, virology or like health matters?
And when he starts using these white supremacist talking points, I go, what's happened to you, man? And then I can almost see like him starting to believe his own story and the adulation. So, listen, how about another song?
Oh, sure, yeah. Why don't we do... So this is just a song that I used to sing to the ladies when I'd pick them up on dates. It's called The Things in My Car. These are the things in my car. All of the wonderful things in my car. A Cuban cigar, an out-of-tune guitar, some pee in a jar, the things in my car. They may not be luxury, but they are everything I need. So come with me and you can see the things in my car. And if I was lucky, I'd bring the girl back to my apartment and sing her this next verse. These are the things in my apartment. All of the wonderful things in my apartment. A little compartment with a silk undergarment and pills for penile enlargement and a letter from the fire department. The things in my apartment. There's some cat poo on the mat, and I don't even have a cat. So tell me what you think of that, and things in my apartment. So by now the girl would be long gone, and I'd sing this last verse to myself. These are the things in my room. All of the wonderful things in my room. A dusty old broom, a Batman costume, a book by Judy Blume, a general sense of impending doom, the things in my room. They may not mean much to thee, but they mean all of the world to me. So come and build a life with me, and the things in my room. The things in my room. Well, my voice did a Peter Brady there. The things in my room. Yeah. That song has gotten me late. No, I'm just kidding. No, it never has, actually. That song I actually co-wrote with my buddy Wade Kelly, who's a very funny guy. Somebody I met really early on doing comedy at the Third Street Promenade at a place called the Upfront Comedy Club. I used to do stuff there.
Got it.
Yeah. And my friend Wade used to also. That place, I think it was probably about 1993 or 4. 93, I think. When a friend of mine asked me to come down there and do one of my songs, because I had just started doing these songs, and I played in front of 12 people, and I was terrified, and it went really well, and I was like, well, maybe this will be something that I'll do for a while, you know? And that was on the Third Street Promenade. It was called the Upfront Comedy Club. It was a little shack next to Johnny's Pizza, And then there was the earthquake, and that took out every business on the block, and they had to rebuild everything. And the Upfront Comedy Club did show up again, but it showed up around the corner on Broadway and 2nd Street, which is now called the Craftsman. And it was magical. That was a lot of fun. You know, it was just a great place to hang. Every Friday night, I'd go down there and do my songs and met so many people. And then you'd have famous people. You know, Chris Farley came in. Robin Williams came in at some point. It was just a hotbed of a lot of improv people, like Second City alumni and stuff. So that was an exciting thing to be a part of. But so I just sort of spent several years doing that in the 90s. And then developed enough of an act so that I started getting asked by friends of mine to open for them on the road. And that's what started doing, like, as a road comedian kind of thing.
Please describe for me how it feels when you tell a joke and there's this wash of laughter that comes back.
It's amazing. Yeah, and the very, very first time I felt it was, I was, I would always like make my friends laugh when I was in high school, not intentionally all the time, but they were just like, they thought I was on pot or something like that. They just thought I was on pot. I already am just saying that I'm not a huge pot smoker. It's like, they thought I was on joint or something. No, but they thought I was high or whatever. They just kind of thought I was a little spacey and weird or whatever, but I'd just sort of make these comments. And I didn't really think anything of it. But then right about that time, maybe 92 or 93, I was in a rut. Like I was in college, but I didn't know one person. All my friends had moved away and I was just by myself here in LA, had no social life at all. But I had a demo of a song that was a pop song, and I was watching, what was that guy's name? Sawyer. Do you remember the talk show host named Sawyer? I'm blanking on his name, or maybe it wasn't, I don't remember. But anyway, he was interviewing Dennis DeYoung, the lead man for Styx, which is a band that I liked a lot, and I was like, you know what?
Tom Sawyer.
No, it wasn't Tom Sawyer. Okay. But maybe it wasn't Sawyer. It was Tom something. But Oh, boy. This is going to drive me crazy.
Sorry, we'll find it. I'll edit it.
Yeah, there you go. Now I'm thinking too much. Yeah, Tom. Oh, it's right on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, so I thought to myself, you know what? I never really do anything. This guy says he's performing tonight at the Cinegro at the Roosevelt Hotel. I'm going to take my demo tape, I'm going to meet him after the show, and I'm going to give him my demo tape. And who knows, maybe he'll laugh at it, the idea that somebody's doing that, but I got to do something. So I went and paid the cover charge to get into the Cinegro, looked on the stage. It wasn't Dennis DeYoung, it was a piano player named Mark Nadler who was doing like cabaret songs. And even though it was very entertaining, it wasn't what I went there for. And I found out later that the show that I was watching had been taped like a year prior. So the idea of giving my demo tape to anybody was out the window. But I went back to the bar and just sat there at the bar and had a couple of beers. And the bartender and I were talking a lot. She was a French girl, and we just got to talking, and I told her I was a musician, and she asked if I played piano at all, and I said, yeah, I mean, very little, but I could. And all of a sudden, toward the end of the night, Mark Nadler, who was on the stage, just, and this was extremely uncharacteristic and random, but he just said, does anybody in the audience have a song that they want to get up here and do? And I didn't say anything. But the bartender did. She was just like, he does. He's got a song. And I was just like, oh, boy, this is weird. So what I had was I had one song. And I can play it in a second. But I had one song that I was doing as a gag for friends of mine that were musicians that I mostly came up with because my friend was going through a breakup. And I started reading headlines just out of the newspaper and then just improvising this melody. And it was just this ridiculous song with all these big words and stuff like that. And so I went up there and on the piano, I sang that song. And it just killed. I don't know what it was. That it was the end of the night. Nobody was really expecting it. People were probably pretty tipsy by this point. It was a fun night. They were all warmed up, and it just really, really killed, you know. And it was a great room anyway. But so I was addicted from that point. I was like, wow, they're all laughing at me. And I felt like this is something that I can really do. And so then I had that in my arsenal, and then I would go and do that song at open mic nights. The Highland Grounds, Molly Malone's, and there were all these places in Hollywood. And then that's when I hooked up with the people at the Upfront Comedy Club. It was basically, I would say, I know it's getting late at night, and I know you're tired, and I know that right now all the headlines have got you down. What do you want me to do about it? And I know that unemployment rates are high, and I know that we're generating high trade deficits, and I know that General Motors just shed 14% of its automotive components operations to accelerate the overhaul of unprofitable North American expenditures, resulting in a loss of nearly 14,000 jobs. But what do you want me to do about it? And I know there's a hole in the ozone layer. That dates it a little bit. And I know that atmospheric temperatures are changing. And I know that most environmental scientists agree that increased carbon dioxide levels caused by the excessive burning of fossil fuels are going to cause the glaciers to melt and the sea levels to rise, thus rendering mankind destined to extinction and the vast death of the entire solar system. But what do you want me to do about it? In Spanish. Yo sé que el mundo es loco. Yo sé que hay muchos problemas. Yo sé que las violaciones de los derechos civiles de migrantes ilegales por la policía migrantes por los problemas que los ciudadanos de México tienen. ¿Pero qué quieres que yo haga en eso? And then I did a verse about, I know there's people dying all over the world. And I know there's people dying right here in the U.S. And I know that despite these problems, Disney executive Michael Eisner just cashed out over $500 million in stock options, which is more than three times the gross national product of the entire Solomon Islands. But what do you want me to do about it? That was the song, and yeah, Michael Eisner, that was the big news story at the time, and there was also, that. I guess this would have been right about, yeah, the end of the George H.W. Bush administration going into Clinton. And yeah, so it's fun sometimes to look back at the current events of what was going on back then. And I would change the song based on new things, you know, like when mad cow disease came, I started, that was like the thing that everybody was talking about. And but have you been here in L.A. the whole time, or like 25 years, 30 years? Or?
I was born in Los Angeles, one of six people who actually were born here. I am what an L.A. person looks like, and it's not pretty.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I came here when I was 12 years old, so I can't claim the native thing, but I've definitely been here a long time. I was once told that you're from wherever it is that you lost your virginity.
Oh, God.
So...
Echo Park?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. That was a horror story. That could have been like a Chucky movie. That was...
I'm from a parking lot in Burbank, I think. But you know, this is a great place. And that entire period of the 90s, for me, was super fun because I was just like... I had an act that I could do, and then suddenly I had a social life. You know, all my friends were... the other people that were performing at the open mic nights or at the improv troupes or at the comedy club. Eventually I started working at the improv comedy club. or just people from the audience. But yeah, it was like instant social life, and I was extremely happy about that.
You know, I used to play a lot of the open mic scene as a cellist. I'm a cello player, and everybody
awesome.
Wants a cellist in their rock, whatever. So I had a similar experience of having a social life, but I found a difference between the comedy performers and all the other artists. The comedy people tended to be dicks.
Oh, the comedians?
like generally kind of difficult people, angry or not friendly.
There is...
I've just lost half my audience.
No, I'm trying to think of a logic there. Well, comedians do tend to be independent spirits because they're used to not working with others like the way that a musician usually does. Yeah, I don't know.
I think people are stealing their jokes a lot. I think to be a comedian, you have to have kind of an edge about you, and even anger or some of these like difficult emotions actually build comedy. So there may be kind of maladaptive people to begin with, unlike musicians.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've met my share of musicians that were dicks.
Shots
fired.
Okay.
No, not
Henry Phillips.
Not orchestral musicians, I will say, but certainly
the tuba players.
No, but I
that's the thing about like. In yoga, they say, well, you have to master the breath, and that makes you enlightened. So, like, are tuba players more... Are they the gurus of this world?
Yeah, because of the breathing.
I mean, I don't know. Is that a...
What do they call it? Circular breathing that you do if you play oboe or something like that, where it's continuous?
Yeah, so the sousaphone players, they're, like, very enlightened beings.
I don't know.
I'm all my old material here.
It's a pretty
Henry Phillips and the mic. Where does the future lie for Henry Phillips? What's the dream, man?
I'm probably similar to you. You've got your podcast. I do a web series. I do a web series called Henry's Kitchen, where I cook and I'm terrible at it, but I try to do it as sincerely as possible. And there's jokes and stuff like that. But it's basically, I think the through line for every kind of comedy that I've ever done is it's funny to be failing at something, you know? When I did my songs, I was sort of like, well, I'm going to be like a songwriter who doesn't really understand that you have to fit it into some kind of meter, and, you know, but I would always try to do it with a sincere delivery, you know, and that's what I'm doing with my kitchen video, but... It went sort of viral. I had one video go up to 1 million views, and I was like, wow. So I was like, maybe there's really something here. So I've kind of turned it into a whole thing. I have merchandise that I sell, and I have a soundtrack album for it, and I make them, every 2 weeks. And I put them on YouTube, and I also put them on Patreon. And
so support Henry Phillips on Patreon.
Patreon.com.
Check out his videos.
/ Henry's Kitchen is where you'd see that. But they're also on. I'm fine if people just go to YouTube and say and put in Henry's Kitchen. I have a blast doing that, and in a weird way, it's something I could see myself doing and growing at. You know, and because it allows me to do music. It allows me to be funny. It allows me to maybe travel, too, because I've noticed that there's more people going to my comedy shows as a result of having these videos, you know? So that's pretty exciting. And in a weird way, it's something I could see myself doing and growing at, you know? And because it allows me to do music. It allows me to be funny. It allows me to maybe travel, too, because I've noticed that there's more people going to my comedy shows as a result of having these videos, you know? So that's pretty exciting.
Another song to wrap things up?
Okay, yeah, let's see here. Boy, that's something's wrong there.
Take your time.
I'm not exactly sure. Okay, well, this is one of the, this is another one of the first songs that I wrote here. This was a really bad breakup that I went through, and it was all her fault. So I wrote this song for her.
abused when she was younger, and her father never up and ran away. And even though her family gave her all the love she needs, somehow she's a bitch anyway. Me, I tried to be her shining hero. I said I love you 2,000 times a day. I showered her with presents bought from the finest shops in town, but somehow she's a bitch anyway. And when I tell her my funny little stories, she'd say, well, I guess you had to be there. I played her to my new song. She said it sucks. And when the evening news shows homeless people, she says it's their own damn fault. But then she hits me up for $50. Somehow she's a bitch anyway. She's a
always gets me.
Can bitch anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Henry Phillips.
Thanks for having
Henry's-
me. Yeah, patreon.com/henryskitchen, or just go to henryphillips.com. It's got everything on there. Tom Snyder.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. I'm sure you enjoyed the interview I did with Henry Phillips and his fun tunes. You can find him at Henry's Kitchen on YouTube. Very entertaining videos, I must say. After the interview, music by Susanna Hancock. We heard Platforms. This will be performed on June 11th at 8 p.m. at the Boomtown Brewery. The Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra is presenting this program. Go to laco.org for more information. The show is called Current Heartbeat. Join them for an exuberant outpouring of community connection and new classical music. This queer-friendly concert celebrates the intersectionality of gender and identity and features a coterie of leading-edge interdisciplinary composers and production artists. Grab a beer and bliss out with LACO at this intimate and relaxed setting. We wrapped up the show with a little bit of music by Mozart. This is to get you ready for the Mark Morris Dance Group and Music Ensemble at the Broad Stage, June 9th through the 12th. Experience the sublime joy of dance with the world-renowned Mark Morris Dance Group in this program called Mozart Dances. More information at thebroadstage.org. And please also check out at the Broad Stage the Conference of the Birds. That's June 18th and 19th. Also an extraordinary show. We'll be back next week with more of the finest of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.